Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, January 15, 2020. Sudanese officials restore calm in the capital after a military mutiny.
All our organized forces shall remain united to support the mandate of the transitional government till the end. We will not allow anyone to plan a coup during this legitimate period.
And Sudanese deputy military leader blames a former chief spy for yesterday's chaos.
There was a demand for dissolving the operations unit of the national security, and indeed the military council has taken the decision on that. We did restructure the new General Intelligence Service.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Four people, including two civilians, were killed as the Sudanese armed forces quelled mutiny by members of the National Intelligence and Security Services in Khartoum. The head of Sudan's Sovereign Council, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, calls the incident a planned conspiracy by a few rogue elements of the previous administration trying to interrupt successful Sudanese revolution. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
Top Sudanese officials say the army is in control of all locations where officers of the National Intelligence and Security Services staged an armed protest yesterday over unpaid salary and demands for better compensation. The army says two soldiers and two civilians were killed when gunfire erupted between the army and dozens of officers from the National Intelligence and Security Service. Four others were injured, including two top army officers. 25-year-old Muhammad Al-Amin and his 19-year-old sister Rania Al-Amin were killed by an exploded ordnance inside their house. Speaking in Arabic, the head of the Sudan Sovereign Council, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, today praised the Sudanese army and rapid support forces for quelling the mutiny.
All our organized forces shall remain united to support the mandate of the transitional government till the end. We will not allow anyone to plan a coup during this legitimate period or allow anyone to mess up with our Sudanese citizens.
Al-Burhan vows to continue working closely with civilian leaders in the transitional government to protect the Sudanese revolution and the country's citizens. Sudanese Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok calls yesterday's armed protests anti-democratic and says Sudan is committed to showing the world that the transitional government will carry out its mandate. Speaking in Arabic, Hamdok says there is no room for spoilers in Sudan.
We thank our Sudanese armed forces, the rapid support forces, for their recognized efforts towards putting an end to this incident, which I believe their main objective is to cut short the development, democracy, stability and peace in Sudan.
Speaking in Arabic, retired Sudanese Police General Ibaidallah Abdul Bari told South Sudan in Focus that the mutiny was a planned incident by people allied with the ousted President Omar al-Bashir, adding it had nothing to do with unpaid arrears.
They are using their hidden cells within the security service who are behind incidents that has been happening in Medeni, Jenina, and Port Sudan. They are trying to cause a situation where Sudanese citizens would come to a conclusion that the forces for freedom and change are not capable of running this country at the moment.
Flights resumed in and out of Khartoum International Airport today. Many shopping centers are open today and people are back to their normal activities. Although the Education Ministry ordered no action, many schools remain closed today. For VOA News, I'm Michael Atit in Khartoum.
A top Sudanese official is blaming the former head of the National Intelligence and Security Services, Salah Abdallah Mohamed, also known as Salah Ghosh, for masterminding Tuesday's mutiny. Sudan's sovereign deputy military leader, Lieutenant General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, says the transitional government will not negotiate with armed protesters. Wake Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
General Dagalo, also known as Hemeti, who heads Sudan's rapid support forces, is in Juba for more talks with the Sudanese rebel groups. Speaking in Arabic to reporters in Juba last night, Hemeti said Goss and other top army and NIS generals were behind the shootings, hoping to create chaos in the transitional government.
There was a demand for dissolving the operations unit of the national security, and indeed the military council has taken the decision on that. We did restructure the new General Intelligence Service.
Hemeti says the decision by the Sovereign Council to reorganize the National Intelligence and Security Service, or NIS, is an effort to strengthen security services during the transitional period. Hemeti says the transitional government offered three options to members of the National Intelligence and Security Service: join the Rapid Support Forces, a paramilitary unit, or the army. For officers not interested in the first two options, they had the third option of being paid their pension and would be retired from the army. Hemeti accuses Goss of mobilizing retired officers to stage the armed protest.
This group is being supported by Salah Gosh, and he has top retired officers and others who are in active service and are planning behind the darkness. They are trying to create this havoc so that national security will still exist. This is the objective.
Goss has worked on and off for the National Security Agency since the 1989 coup that brought former President Bashir to power. Under his leadership, the NIS was one of the most feared state institutions that Bashir used to crush any form of rebellion against his government. Goss resigned from his position in April shortly after Bashir's ouster. Hemeti says before yesterday's incident, a similar protest took place in Kordofan. He says all attempts by Goss or other groups linked to him are aimed at destabilizing Sudan, but they will not work.
These are demands that would put our country into problems. I call upon all our people in West Kordofan not to heed to this demand. There are few individuals who are behind these demands. Use the law to claim your demand.
Hemeti called on any officers who took part in yesterday's protest to hand over their weapons. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Still on Sudan, the UN Refugee Agency is appealing for $447 million to provide essential aid for more than 900,000 refugees in Sudan and for nearly 250,000 Sudanese hosting them. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency is teaming up with more than 30 other partners to provide the refugees with shelter, health, education, and other crucial aid for survival. The vast majority of refugees are from South Sudan. But the agency says resources also are needed for refugees from 9 other countries who have fled violence and persecution. In the meantime, UNHCR spokesman Baba Balor says Sudan continues to receive new refugees, putting more pressure on diminishing resources.
In Darfur, an ongoing influx of refugees from Central African Republic into remote parts of Sudan and Central Darfur states has seen the number of refugees swell from just over 5,000 to nearly 17,000 in the 3 months since September 2019.
All this is occurring at a time when Sudan is going through an historical political transition. In April, Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir was ousted after nearly 30 years in power. The UNHCR reports transitional authorities are struggling to achieve peace and stability while mired in a severe economic crisis and faced with an internally displaced population of 1.8 million. Balash tells VOA, refugees in Sudan are scattered over 130 locations across the country's 18 states, some in very remote areas.
They live side by side among their hosts. Sudanese have been sharing resources with the refugees. We need to keep our continued support with the refugees that are in Sudan, but also their hosts who also live on scarce resources.
UNHCR operations in Sudan tend to be greatly underfunded. Last year's appeal for $269 million received only 32% of that amount. The agency is appealing to the international community to be more generous this year and provide the money needed to aid an ever-growing number of destitute people. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
From Geneva, we come back to Juba, where some South Sudanese lawmakers are calling on the government to suspend oil production in parts of former Unity State following a pipeline explosion near Rueng State this week. A lawmaker in the Council of State, South Sudan's upper chamber of parliament, attributes the explosion and fire to a failure by the oil companies to maintain its oil facilities. Lasuba Memo has this story for VOA from Juba.
Rueng State Information Minister Abraham Atoy tells South Sudan in Focus a fire particle caused explosion as welders were trying to fence off a pool of oil that leaked from a ruptured pipeline near the Tiong oil production facility.
Through the welding, the fire struck and then it dropped into that pond. Then it caught fire. Otherwise, the workers, when they saw that the crude has caught fire, people ran for their safety and they are now okay.
No casualties were reported from the fire, but Matoi says a driver working for the welders was transported to a health facility due to smoke inhalation. In speaking in Arabic, area resident Peter Kwan says he and other residents are suffering from the polluted atmosphere as a result of the fire.
Truly, so many people are coughing, there is flu and others spewed because of smoke from the burning oil.
Matoi says it is conceivable that some residents are having a hard time breathing with all the smoke caused by the fire.
Some of the residents were in their farms trying to harvest the sagam in that area. You know, maybe some of them have been affected because of the smoke. But I personally, I have no idea about those cases.
MP Mary Ayen, who represents Rueng State in the Council of State, is calling on the government to halt production at the facility and mandate that ruptured pipelines be fixed as well as all surrounding water and land be cleaned before the oil facility, owned and operated by the Greater Pioneer Operating Company, is allowed to operate again.
We are not seeing that those accidents are coming to an end. They are continuing to take place. That's why I'm saying, yes, it is a serious decision to say that to suspend the production until we put things in order. Because at the end, if there is an accident like yesterday, the production was halted for 13 hours. Then it is a loss to the environment and it's a loss also economically.
In late December, an oil spill in Kailoe, located about 10 kilometers west of the Unity oil field, caught fire, lasting for 2 days, sending thick trails of smoke into the air. It is owned and operated by the Greater Pioneer Operating Company. Duai Keke Toreal, who represents Northern Leech State in South Sudan's National Legislative Assembly, supports Ayen's suggestion.
This is not one-time incident. This has been continuing for the last 3 months. We want to understand why the Ministry of Petroleum and the operating companies are unable to stop this rupture and subsequently the fire that come along the eruption.
Repeated calls to Petroleum Minister Awol Daniel Chuang for comment on the explosion and ruptured pipeline went unanswered. Last Friday, the minister called for a comprehensive environmental audit of all oil-producing areas to assess the extent of pollution in the environment. The government has yet to select a company to carry out the audit. For VOA News, I am Lasuba Memo in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at human rights records in 2019. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what do you do to conserve your energy when it is very hot outside? I drink lots of cold water because it relaxes me. So immediately I become dehydrated or I feel hot. I take in more cold water, yes, and it makes me okay.
Well, I live around the beach, so on a hot day, I just take a stroll on the shore wearing a light cloth so that I can feel the sea breeze around myself.
If it is hot, you have to make sure that you get somewhere where it is cool. You go and bathe. Those are normal things you have to do.
When I'm at my home, I undress. It is my home. I have a bedroom. My home is big. Why won't I undress?
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. 2019 was a year of mass protests on the African continent, with demonstrators filling the streets in capitals like Conakry, Harare, Khartoum, and Kinshasa. While the cause of their grievances varied, the protesters shared one unfortunate characteristic: a harsh response from security forces. VOA's Anita Powell brings us this report from Johannesburg.
There was rage across the African continent last year, says Human Rights Watch in its annual report, with no sign of cooling down. Anger at entrenched leaders in Guinea and Sudan, poor economy in Zimbabwe, and over conflict displaced people in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Ethiopia. But the public outrage is good to see, said the rights group's Africa Advocacy Director, Karine Kaneza Nantulia, at the launch of the report in Johannesburg.
We've seen, I think, the average men and women of the African continent taking agency, being agents for their own, for the changes they wanted to see. We saw an increase of peaceful protest in different countries. The second, I think, takeaway is that we've also seen a backsliding from government in terms of political and civic space.
In some countries in southern Africa, that meant police aggression and repression, says Human Rights Watch. Dewa Mavinga is the rights group's Southern Africa researcher.
We expected more from Southern African leaders, including President Ramaphosa of South Africa, based on their commitments and promises to fulfill people's rights across the region. But we saw that there was a constriction of space for human rights defenders. In countries like Zimbabwe, there was a clampdown on protesters, excessive use of force by the police and the other arms of the security forces. There was no accountability whatsoever.
But there was also hope, as Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed won the Nobel Peace Prize for liberal reforms and making peace with arch-enemy Eritrea. Babatunde Olugboji is Human Rights Watch's Africa Deputy Advocacy Director.
He's done quite a few great things in Ethiopia. He's released political prisoners. He's actually reforming some repressive laws. He sort of made peace with Eritrea. So things are moving in the right direction, mostly. There is still a lot to be done in Ethiopia.
South Africa takes over the African Union's rotating chairmanship this year, notes Human Rights Watch's Southern Africa researcher, Mavinga. With the continent's most progressive constitution, South Africa's leadership raises some expectations, he says.
South Africa has to step up to the plate. It has to deliver on human rights and draw back on Mandela's legacy. But we will have to continue to push.
And as 2019 made clear, African people will be behind them, demanding their rights and that their voices be heard. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
1 year ago, the Al-Shabaab militant group attacked a hotel and office complex in Nairobi, killing 21 people. A year has passed, but the memory of that day still haunts those who survived, as we hear from Muhammad Yusuf in Nairobi.
Juliet will never forget January 15, 2019. She says early that day she had planned to call her sister, who worked in Dusit D2 office complex.
At that particular day, I was like, and I was going to call her, but because of where I was, I couldn't call. So I said, once I'm done is when I'll give her the call. Little did I know that was not to happen.
Juliet, who asked that we use an alias, tried to call her sister when she learned that gunmen had opened fire inside Dusit D2, but the call did not go through. She went to the complex and paced nervously through an area near the attack in search of her sister, hoping she was a survivor. 12:30, she feared the worst.
So when we got to Chiromo, so the attendant was like, we can't allow you to see the bodies now until tomorrow because we need to do a few things and whatnot. But I was like, please, I'm assisted to maybe one of the deceased, but just let me see whoever is there. I was a bit hesitant. Then there were already some security guys who had already come. So one of them told the guy, like, attend, like, no, just let them see. If there's someone there that's theirs, let them just see, then they'll confirm. So that's when we're allowed to see. So when we saw, we identified it was her.
Juliet's sister was one of the 21 people killed by Al-Shabaab attackers who stormed the complex. Kenyan security officers engaged the attackers for 20 hours before ending the siege. At the end of the attack, at least 1,000 people escaped with their lives. June Chepkemei survived the attack. She was attending a conference in the hotel when they heard sounds of explosion and gunfire. She and six others hid in one of the hotel rooms.
I think it was around 5 p.m. Before that, we had several bangs at the door. And we had been told that any bank don't open, those are actually the tourists. And we had several of such banks. But we were told the security personnel who are coming to our rescue will not knock. They will simply break and secure you. So at some point at around 5, the door was broken and a team of rescuers, a huge battalion, walked in and they came and rescued us. And they took us down the stairs. Step by step, we were still hearing shootings all over the place.
Ronald Ngeno survived the attack and went back to work in the complex, but the place has never been the same for him.
Immediately after the attack, they increased the security a lot, and right now we feel very secure. However, most of us don't feel comfortable. For example, to go and have lunch or have meals at the places where we know people were killed. And
Kenyan authorities were praised for reacting to the terror attack quickly, unlike the Westgate Mall attack in 2013, where 67 people were killed. Kenyan security agencies made dozens of arrests. Some were released after interrogation. Mustafa Ali is a Horn of Africa security analyst.
The government now need to focus a lot of their attention to prevention and ensuring that radicalization into extremism that leads to recruitment by Al-Shabaab among the Kenyan population is reduced, is prevented, and stopped.
So far, six people accused of playing roles in the Dusit D2 attack are awaiting trial. Meanwhile, Al-Shabaab continues to carry out attacks in the northeastern and coastal regions of Kenya. In less than a week, Al-Shabaab fighters attacked two schools in Garissa County, killing four students and three teachers. The terror group wants Kenya to leave Somalia. The East African nation troops are part of the African Union force fighting Al-Shabaab and providing support to the Somali government. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
From Nairobi, we move to Zimbabwe, where schools have opened after the year-end break. But most teachers aren't there due to a deadlock with the government over pay. Teachers say the economic decline has dramatically reduced the buying power of their salaries, and they want their pay pegged to the US dollar. Reporter Jose Zenivashi has more from Harare.
The build-up to schools opening for another education term has been tense. Teachers urged government to review their salaries and peg them against the interbank foreign exchange market. Raymond Majongwe is the Secretary General of the Progressive Teachers Union of Zimbabwe.
Those that we know have not gone to school, and our point is very clear. Teachers are not on strike, we are incapacitated. We can't go and borrow money from moneylenders to go to work. We can't subsidize the government. Teachers are not at work, and if they are there, they are not working.
Teachers, as well as other government employees, say that soaring inflation has eroded their salaries so far that they cannot afford to travel to work and are thus incapacitated. Over the past few years, Zimbabwe's economy was weakened sharply, with shortages of everything from cash to food to fuel, in addition to inflation. The problems have been worsened by a prolonged drought that has cut harvests and has reduced the output at hydropower dams. On Monday, the government announced cushioning allowances for civil servants as negotiations for salaries continue. The talks have dragged longer than expected, and last Friday, the Apex Council representing government workers turned down a 97% salary increase. Majongwe says the cushion allowances work against civil servants.
It's an insult. It doesn't address anything. In actual fact, it actually exacerbates and then changes us into more poverty.
In the recent past, any allowance or salary increase has influenced price hikes. As a result, teachers and other civil servants want their salaries indexed against the interbank market exchange rates. Obed Masaraure is the president of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe.
We encourage the government to urgently intervene and resolve the salary crisis so that at least we have our teachers back to school. We want the best for our public schools because this is the only way we can ensure that education is accessed by the ordinary poor people.
He adds that the negotiations are pointless and government should comply with the demands of the teachers. He vows that until government agrees to index salaries against the interbank market, then there will be no learning in schools. Parents feel cheated in all this. They struggled in the harsh economic climate to pay school fees and get supplies for their children to return to school. But now their children will not be learning. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zunawashe from Harare.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Kalina Shtakal by Lomerika Sun.
Kelina isawa, Asha sala pelete, Kelina isawa. Wa mungula wa wana sasi ya satal farid mabu wa dina gita.
Kelina shtaka, asha sana belede. Kelina shtaka, asha sana belede.
Kelina sibu shoko kasilani ya kona
Kelina shtaka.
Kelina sibu duku kasu maguwa tsakit ya kona
Kelina shtaka.
The hate speak big kelimu. Fedet nina bisena sifir 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 bikarabunina will create discriminations among our community. Let's stop doing this. Matagul kalamde kalide jenge kalide nyam nyam kalide sorwiti kalamade kulumakwe. I shan't get a shabam. Again, I must mark a lamb day. And our entire most of the
Kalina Shtakal.
We've been listening to Lomerika Sun with the song Kalina Shtakal, which means let us get down to work. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Boda, boda,
delícia.
Oh, sala atali zatu.